Thank you very much. So yes, we're going to go into now the intervention that could be done with this data very quickly. I am president of Rescue Social Change Group, so I do have to disclose that. We do young adult tobacco prevention interventions. And so let's talk about that. So Rescue is we are a social change organization based in San Diego and with offices around the country. And this is an intervention that we manage that was evaluated by University of California, San Francisco, led by Dr. Pam Ling. And the data that you saw in the previous presentation is actually pulled from some of that evaluation. So I'm going to be presenting their evaluation of the intervention. So the tobacco industry, as you heard, has been targeting young adults for about 20 years now. They do bar and club-based promotions. They know that this is an area where they can really reach young adults effectively. And ever since, particularly since the Master Settlement Agreement, have very much focused even more on young adults in bar and club settings. Even though there are some restrictions now, like not being able to give away free samples and things like that, they still are able to give away coupons. They're still able to get you on their direct mail list. And they're able to do a lot of association between that environment and the kind of sexiness and the fun and the party atmosphere with being a smoker. And that's really their ultimate goal, is to associate those so that individuals who are partying take up smoking. This is an example of some of their marketing. This was a Salem event in San Diego that was a fashion show / hip-hop club night. This is another example of something that they've done. They've actually been at bars giving free massages to people. And here is a little excerpt from one of their top secret documents that talked about the Camel Club program is for the brand to enjoy increased awareness and usage by the mainstream smoking market, and this awareness and usage will be increased due to the mainstream perception of the Camel brand as a hip, trendy brand. This trickle-down marketplace phenomenon ensures that what begins as an alternative trend ultimately becomes a mainstream one. And what they're referring to here is their focus on trendsetters. So the tobacco industry for a long time has understood that it's not about mass appeal, that they don't have to go and reach every single person, but if they reach a select few people who are trendsetters, who influence others, they will be able to reach all the friends and people who look up to those trendsetters. And that continues to be their focus in bars and clubs. So counter-marketing in bars and clubs has both advantages and disadvantages. First of all, it is a very local presence. It's a very interactive presence. It's not necessarily like a commercial where it's just one way. You know, your promotions at a bar and club can interact with the patrons. You can build relationships with venues in order to make them see that there's two sides to bar promotions, so that when they are approached by the tobacco industry, you build a little bit of resilience amongst the venue owners themselves. You can also tailor what you're doing to the specific bar, to the specific culture, which really allows you to deliver a very tailored message based on the culture that you're trying to reach. And more importantly, there is no smoking in bars and clubs in most cities now in the U.S., still not all of them, but that you can at least have that work to your advantage. One of the disadvantages on our end is that, of course, our budget is one-tenth, if we're lucky, of their budget, of the tobacco industry's budget. So some of the tobacco industry documents actually show how much they spent. There's a document out there that shows a plan for Chicago where they were spending about $1 million a year just on bar and club promotions. So this is definitely something that they invest a lot of money in. We don't necessarily have a pre-established brand or image that we can kind of fall back on. However, that can be both an advantage and a disadvantage. You know, if someone doesn't like a certain brand or image, you can create a new one and really reach them in a new way. The way that we did our study initially was to first understand what were the subcultures that existed in San Diego. And this process, we call it identity-based segmentation, and it's based on these five-minute intercept surveys where we got the data that you saw in the previous presentation, but also got a sense of what subculture these young adults identified with. So we use images and a scoring method to determine which of five or six different subcultures from San Diego that were identified during formative research that they identify with by combining both pictures that they select with bars and clubs that they select in the survey. Around the country, we have done this research in about 12 different cities already, and there's four main subcultures that emerge in every city with young adults. There are additional ones that may or may not appear, but these are the four that we always see. First, there's a hip-hop urban subculture, and these are bars and clubs that have particularly DJs that are particularly playing hip-hop music. These clubs are usually a lot more ethnic, not necessarily one ethnicity, but they are a white minority. And they, of course, are connected to the global hip-hop community. Then we have the party or trendy clubs. These are kind of the bars that you imagine when you say, the college bar or the place where people are just going to listen to top 40 music and dance, pubs and things, sports bars, all that kind of fits into this big umbrella. It's a mixture of all sorts of kinds of music. The DJ will play everything from a dance version of a rock song to a hip-hop song, and it is pretty culturally diverse as well. Then we have the hipsters, alternative rock bars. These are usually smaller bars, and these usually focus on live music over DJs. They like different kinds of rock and alternative music, and these young adults are considered to be very trendy. A lot of marketing companies, as well as the tobacco industry, consider these to be the trendsetters. The tobacco industry actually names hipsters by name in a lot of their documents as being a prime target for them, because they're the ones who experiment with things, who try things out, and then they disseminate through the other subcultures. And then finally, we have the gay and lesbian population, and for gay and lesbians, bars and clubs are even more important than they are for straight young adults, because this, for many of them, is one of the first places that they feel 100% comfortable. So bars and clubs in the gay and lesbian community often become sort of a community center in a way, and the tobacco industry knows this and taps into that, and has associated itself with that community feeling for many years. So in San Diego, when we did our initial formative research, we looked at these four subcultures, and mainstream means the partier group. And what we found was that the group that had the highest tobacco use rate was actually hipsters. So they had an even higher rate than the gay and lesbian population. And this is, we probably don't see this because usually we're looking at straight or gay and lesbian, black or white. We're not really looking at lifestyles. And so this was one of the first times where we got to look at the actual lifestyles of young adults, not just their demographics, to understand their smoking rates. And those who identified with the hipster lifestyle both had a higher current smoking rate as well as a regular smoking rate. So we decided to develop an intervention to target the hipster community in San Diego. And to learn a little bit more about hipsters, they also enjoy local art. So not just do they like bands, but they also like to support their local artists, local fashion designers, local everything. They have a very anti-corporate mentality, but at the same time are the biggest smokers. So there's definitely a disconnect between those two attitudes there. They're very skeptical about who enters their scene, which kind of makes it a little bit harder for us to go in, but they very much value the authenticity when they see it. So whether it's in an artist or in a band or in a new clothing line or whatever, they will go and support that entity when they see that it is a part of their culture and that it is authentic. Others also perceive them to be as smokers. So when we do focus groups with the urban population or with partiers or LGBT, and we say, who are the smokers, everyone else perceives hipsters to be the ones that are smoking the most. So it's... the perception is reality in this sense. So the strategy that we developed to target this group, we call it social branding, and we define it as a behavioral change strategy that utilizes certain commercial marketing tactics to change the social image that's associated with certain behaviors within specific peer group populations. So these subcultures that we just looked at, we refer to them as peer groups, and the strategy is really to say we pick one peer group and develop a method to essentially reorganize the association. So if that group has associated smoking with being a hipster, our goal is to associate being a hipster with not smoking. And that everything that this intervention does is specifically to undo that association. The process begins by understanding who the target market is, what their social needs are, what their identity is, and then introducing a brand that actually has the ability to compete with the existing current role models. So in this culture of hipsters, there are individuals who are trendsetting, who are well-known, who are popular. Our goal is to create a brand that is just as popular, just as influential as those trendsetters, and so that it builds the social authority to be able to introduce a new behavior. So you can imagine that if this group believes that smoking is something that hipsters do, and then they see a generic anti-smoking message, they're not going to connect that with their subculture. They're going to say, sure, that's for everyone else, that's for them. But I know my culture, and in my culture, we smoke. So what we have to do is be able to be strong enough to go into their culture as something that looks and talks and acts like them to be able to change that association. Once we have built enough social authority, that is when we begin to introduce the new behavior, and we introduce it as a change from within. The goal is not to say, here's the government pointing at you, telling you guys need to stop smoking. It's another hipster who's saying, our culture is now evolving. Just like a new fashion trend, just like anything else that's new in the culture, hating smoking is a new thing, and we're going to now not like smoking anymore. And then the stronger reinforcement, so really pointing out when this happens, finding social opportunities to reinforce those who are choosing not to smoke, who are choosing to be vocal about not smoking, is all important to sustain this process and keep the cycle going. So this is what Commune looks like. It is a hipster campaign, and it focuses on a monthly club night at a local hipster bar and club that includes a local artist, a local band, a local fashion designer, and a local boutique that all come together and form the Commune. And the goal is to have all of these influential people that are from within the community express their support for being smoke-free vocally. Because a lot of times what we see in these cultures is not that there's not that many non-smokers, it's that you don't know when someone's a non-smoker. Because they're usually not saying anything. You know, smokers have times when they're not smoking either. So a smoker assumes everyone else smokes. And they're not really aware of just how many people don't smoke and don't like it. So our goal is to try and put those people on stage and get them to say that they don't smoke and that they support a smoke-free scene. This is what hipsters look like, if you were wondering. They do like mustaches and tattoos. And this is from some of the events, so you can see one of the bands there. And our message cards going to good use. We also include direct mail. So one of the very big strategies of the tobacco industry is direct mail. Once they get your address, if you guys have ever had a chance to do that, you get mail once a week from them for a little while until they realize that you're not using their coupons. So we do direct mail as well. It's once a month, and it promotes the upcoming event as well as has pictures from the previous event. And then on the inside, it has a poster. And the poster is the art piece that the current artist put together that is about smoking. So every month, the artist that's recruited from within the community is asked to put together a custom art piece that has to do with some sort of anti-tobacco fact. And so that to us is the authentic, you know, solidifying that this artist really genuinely doesn't like smoking and express that to their peers in a way by creating these art pieces. Here's a couple more, and you actually have a whole bunch of samples of these in your bag, different posters that have been made. The fashion designer also is asked to create a custom fashion piece that is anti-smoking as well. And usually we are able to coordinate their facts, so that night is all focused on a certain fact like deforestation or animal testing or things like that. We try and focus a little bit more on the social justice issues because this subculture is so motivated by social justice and being anti-big corporations and things like that. We've had the evaluation now in place for about 3 years. And we've got the baseline. The first follow-up was about 10 months after. The second follow-up was, 22 months after. And then the third follow-up is still in progress. This is about 800 of the 1,200 surveys that we collect each year. The data are split up into three groups. So the lighter line is our total sample. The middle line is our hipsters, which is about 60% of the sample. And hipsters are people who, through their selection of pictures and bars, were identified to actually be a part of the hipster subculture. And then beyond that, we have a scale that we created to try and measure how influential someone is, how socially influential is, based on how often they go out, what their personality is like, things like that. And so using that, we're actually able to create this group, this consistent group from wave to wave that we call our high social concern, our high leaders, social leaders of the hipster community. And that is about 12% of the sample from group to group. So you can see the three different lines there that our exposure has sort of grown over time, sort of stabilized, but is always higher amongst the hipsters and is always higher amongst the high social concern hipsters. Now, here we kind of introduce a radical idea, which is that we don't necessarily believe that we need high awareness to cause change. This is, you know, a translation that's come from commercial world that we say, oh, we need 90% awareness rate to be able to change behavior. In reality, we don't, because all we need is that social leader not to smoke, and someone else to copy that social leader. They don't need to know why that social leader didn't smoke or what brand led them not to smoke. In the commercial world, you need to know that it's Pepsi that you're drinking in order to drink Pepsi following on. But for us, you don't really need to know that. So this is kind of a crazy idea there that maybe we don't need high exposure to cause change. Our liking the campaign has also grown over time, and our high social concern hipsters are the ones that like it the most. And more importantly, our current smoking. So current smoking has gone down about 15% in the overall sample, but that decrease is larger amongst hipsters and is even larger amongst high social concern hipsters. I think I have here's the exact numbers. So about 17.5% decrease overall, 21.7% over high social concern hipsters. And unexpectedly, we actually also measured a decrease in binge drinking, amongst the same population from 78% to 63%. And our theory there is kind of, you know, bars and clubs are public health message deserts. So as soon as you go in with any health message, that it's possible that there is some health consciousness going on through in general. So a little bit less binge drinking if they're thinking, trying to be a little healthier. So bars and clubs are a priority area intervention for us. We have been able to find an intervention that's showing strong promise, and we are continuing this intervention. So hopefully we can continue to see these rates decrease, and also have the intervention in a few other cities that we're evaluating as well, with adding control cities, which is something we did not have for this. So we hope with the addition of some control communities, we can provide even more data and evidence that, that social branding is a promising strategy for young adult tobacco reduction. All right, and with that, take any questions. Yes?
Did you track methods of cessation? In terms of what they did?
We have a question that does ask them if they've called the quit line and things like that, and it's not very high. We actually have a quit group that's incorporated into the intervention that's a separate study that is a quit group that actually meets at bars and clubs, and have been able to do that with about 30, 40 people or so that we consider to be very influential in the scene. So we know some people have quit through that, but otherwise, they don't really call the quit line from what we can tell. That if they quit, they were occasional smokers that decided to stop being occasional smokers or just quit on their own. Yes?
Since we know that if drinking and smoking kind of go hand in hand, and if we're discouraging smoking, then drinking is going down. So, I mean, are bar owners really receptive to us going in and doing smoking cessation project?
We have never told the bar owner that this has happened. And we actually have seen it with some of our other interventions, because I had a bar owner tell me once that the event we hosted was the biggest night they've ever had numbers-wise, but the sales weren't as big as he expected. So we've heard it in other places, and I'd be like, I don't know what happened. You know, that's weird. I think that binge drinking is definitely something that gets in the way of tobacco prevention. Drinking alone is probably not, and we didn't see any kind of change in just drinking rates. We only saw change in binge drinking rates. So as long as we keep that to ourselves, I think we'll be okay.
And what other cities?
We're currently in Albuquerque and Las Cruces, New Mexico, Oklahoma City and Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Virginia Beach, Virginia. Yes? I think that was simply just some secondary research that was brought in, yeah. Yes?
Are you selling the t-shirts and posters and things and trying to establish like somewhat of a market presence for things like regeneration and like people who maybe don't identify as hipsters from your study, but like they kind of want to be hipsters? And, like, a lot of people are non-hipsters who wouldn't necessarily
right. Right. We do. The t-shirts at the event are sold. The posters are free, and the artist is usually there signing his or her posters. And so we have been able to sell a few. We give away a lot of them. We haven't put any emphasis on selling them. So one of our other brands that's actually for teenagers will go to some of the big alternative rock festivals and sell like over 100 shirts in one day. So there's definitely a market for them. That hasn't been an emphasis for us, because selling clothes is more of a national strategy. To really build a market than a local strategy. But when there is an opportunity, we do sell it and people do buy it. Yes?
As you know, the effects you're seeing are due to sort of branding, since relationships or intentions to your business.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And so that's why our research continues with the control communities. One of the good signs that we have that this could be what's happening is that the decrease is more pronounced with hipsters, and then more pronounced with high social concern hipsters. So the market that we have said, you know, all along is the market we're targeting is the one that's showing a bigger decrease. But that's, of course, just, you know, one more clue in the puzzle. What we hope is that San Diego is going to have a control community added as part of a new grant. And so we hope that with that additional data, we can build more confidence that that's what's happening. Yes.
Uh,
theoretically, within social branding, I actually believe it makes it harder when they're highly affluent. What we've seen with both teenagers and young adults, because we have some of these kind of campaigns with teens as well, is that the lower education you have, the lower socioeconomic status you are, the more that your image sometimes matters. And so when it's highly affluent and, you know, they argue with you and they kind of think through it more. And I think that that creates a barrier to change for them. When lower affluence or lower education are sometimes just like, oh, that's the next trend, I need to go after it, and don't ask as many questions. So I think we succeeded despite their affluence. Thank you.